طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. Today we revisit the struggle of pro-Palestinian activists in the United States who try to counter the well-funded attempts by the pro-Israeli lobby to silence criticism of Israel. We focus on the efforts of two organizations that provide legal resources to support the organizing efforts of pro-Palestinian activists who resist efforts to silence them, the American Civil Liberties Union and Palestine Legal. In a forum at the Washington Press Club, the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs featured Youssef Munayer of the Middle East Institute, Brian House from the ACLU Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project, and Mira Shah, senior attorney at Palestine Legal. It begins with Youssef Munayer framing the issue.
Good morning, everyone. Very excited to be talking about these topics here and to be part of this outstanding panel that's really going to dig into some of these issues in detail. So really looking forward to this conversation and questions from the audience as well. My task is to sort of frame this conversation and also give some background and context into the extent of what's going on and sort of where it came from and the strategy behind it. And I want to provide a little bit of context to help us do that. First, some historical context, which I think is important. What we are talking about today is essentially the repression of global dissent around Israel's policies and treatment of Palestinians. And while this is something we are seeing today, it's important to remember that Israel's repression of Palestinian dissent is something that is as old as the state of Israel itself. And has been practiced and has existed on both sides of the Green Line over the last 75 years or so. And I'm talking here not just about the repression of Palestinian armed resistance, but also the repression of Palestinian civil society in Israel and the territory it occupies as well. So what we're seeing now is not something that is fundamentally new, but something that has transformed and internationalized to target dissent against Israeli policy across borders. And so that's the first sort of piece of historical context that I wanted to offer to frame our discussion. The second is that while today we are going to be talking about this dynamic here in the United States, it is not only happening here in the United States, but these efforts are happening in many places across the globe, here in the United States, but also in Europe as well, in many different countries, where we are seeing efforts through laws being passed, lawfare being practiced to target and silence dissent against Israeli policy and treatment of Palestinians. So this is, while again today we will be focusing here on the United States, this is not only happening here in the United States. And that brings us to sort of the third piece of context, is that this is not sort of happening in a haphazard way or out of coincidence, but rather this is an effort that is being supported, coordinated, and encouraged by the Israeli government itself through its official channels and its unofficial channels as well. And I want to talk a little bit about that and how that has evolved over time to bring us to the moment that we are in today. This, of course, has happened significantly over the last 15 years, concurrent with a pretty extreme shift in Israeli politics further and further to the right, which I think is important because the sort of ecosystem of organizations, politicians, and financial supporters of these efforts exist largely within the right-wing sphere of Israeli politics. And as the political parties that represent the Israeli right assumed greater and greater political control over government, we saw a concurrent growth in policies of repression and the internationalization of repression through the organs of the Israeli government itself. So I think all of that is sort of important context to begin with. Historically, I would divide this into basically three different periods over the last 20 years or so. From 2005 to 2010, let's say, then from 2010 to 2015, and then from 2015 through today. And I want to talk a little bit about each of those periods and how things have kind of changed. Of course, you know, in the mid-2000s, we were really in the midst of the second Palestinian uprising, the Intifada. We saw the complete breakdown of, the quote-unquote peace process. For those who bought into the belief that there was going to be sort of an internationally sponsored diplomatic solution to the plight of Palestinians, that crumbled during that time and has only continued to deteriorate since then. And this gave rise to growing global civil society efforts to demand accountability as it became clear that the United States' mediated peace efforts were not going to bring justice for Palestinians, as it became clear that the international community was not going to be able to do that. Global civil society increasingly stepped up with demands for accountability, led really by Palestinian civil society and through the Palestinian call for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions, which was modeled after, of course, previous transnational advocacy campaigns like the anti-apartheid movement, which called on global civil society actors to stand in solidarity with the people who were oppressed by taking the actions that they could in their own communities through these different tactics, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And from this time through 2010, you saw the increasing growth of this movement. And importantly, the end of this period was, of course, capped by a major and horrific event, which was the massive war on Gaza from the end of 2008 into 2009, which was in many ways paradigm shifting event, and a scale of attack on Gaza that we had not seen before, and also an event that turned many, many more people away from supporting the state of Israel and really added fuel to this effort internationally to demand for accountability. During this period as well, towards the tail end of it, we began to see growing attacks within Israel against left-wing groups within Israel, or so-called left-wing groups within Israel, human rights defenders and NGOs that supported a more critical stance towards Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. And we began to see laws being passed inside Israel targeting these NGOs, scrutinizing their funding, and laws being passed inside Israel as well, targeting things like expression of commemoration for the Nakba. And so there was this sort of growing pattern of steps being taken by the Israeli government to silence both those who were critical of Israeli government and those who were expressing any support for Palestinians as well. In 2010, of course, we saw the effort to break the siege on Gaza by a flotilla of boats that was also led by members of global civil society, which was a moment that really shocked the Israeli political establishment into action around further repression of any kinds of global civil society efforts. And this was seen as sort of a wake-up call within Israeli policy circles to shift their approach towards international criticism and dissent within global civil society. And this brings us to sort of the second period from 2010 to 2015, where you have this growing debate in Israeli policy circles over how Israeli government policy should shift to dealing with this issue. And there are largely two camps within Israeli policy circles on how to deal with this issue. One could be sort of characterized as the Hasbara camp or the diplomacy camp, which says, you know, we need to just do a better job explaining the Israeli story, telling our narrative, showing people what's great about Israel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if we do that, then that's the best way to sort of combat criticism of Israeli policy towards Palestinians. And another side is a side that really grew during this period and ultimately ended up winning the debate. And that's the side that said, no, we can't just practice diplomacy. We can't just talk about our side of the story. We actually have to go on the attack. And this is really important. Because this characterized a shift in Israeli government policy towards global civil society dissent that ended up becoming formalized in organs of the Israeli government. And this was a policy that was developed by an Israeli think tank that was very close to the Israeli government called the Reut Institute. They argued for several sort of central principles in a new policy towards addressing the challenge of global civil society dissent, and this was one of the key principles. Shifting from defense to offense is how they characterized it. And in other words, instead of explaining themselves, they would attack the sources of dissent. And this became a central pillar of Israeli policy moving forward. Other principles included the idea of it takes a network to defeat a network. And so the Israeli government began moving towards establishing a network of allies, which would help it extend its coercive force transnationally across borders. So in other words, it worked with partners, like-minded partners, in the United States, in Europe, and elsewhere to advance certain repressive objectives like anti-BDS legislation, like lawfare campaigns, like smear campaigns, like the targeting of students at campuses, all of which we're going to talk about in greater detail. And in 2015, this became formalized in Israeli government organs through the creation of something called the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs, which was handed a mandate by the security cabinet in Israel and a significant budget with which to carry out these objectives, to build and support a network of allies that could advance these repressive efforts across borders, and the funding with which to carry this out. And so in the years since 2015, we've seen a significant escalation in these efforts, not just in anti-BDS legislation, but in lawfare attacks and in smear campaigns as well. And most recently, and I think importantly for the future, the effort to reframe dissent against Israeli policy towards Palestinians as anti-Semitism through the passage of laws, regulations, which adopt a definition of anti-Semitism that can easily be construed to cover most forms of criticism of Israel. And this is an effort that is intended to target dissenters, and to do so in a way, I think, and I know that both Brian and Mira will get into this in greater detail, that can help them sidestep the challenge of this very important thing we call the First Amendment or free speech protections here in the United States. Because if criticism of Israeli policy can be framed as discrimination, it's a lot harder to defend on First Amendment grounds. And so we are seeing a shift today, within this repressive effort to move towards greater use of this definition of anti-Semitism, greater adoption and enforcement of it in the hopes that it can have a repressive effect against dissenters while also sidestepping some of the challenges that we see anti-BDS legislation coming under because of its violation of the First Amendment and free speech principles. I will stop there. I know there's plenty more to say on this, and I really look forward to hearing what the others have to say and can add more in the Q&A, but wanted to provide sort of that context for our conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Yusuf, for this really great comprehensive overview and context. I think it's a great setup for the rest of the discussion as we get into more details. Next up, we have Brian, who will focus a little bit more on the anti-boycott legislation at state and national levels, and maybe how these have been challenged in courts. And maybe if you could, if you have a little bit of time, to touch on the role of media and on censorship and free speech at the end. Brian, go ahead.
Thanks so much, Tamara. It's a pleasure to be here speaking with you all this morning together with my distinguished co-panelists. The ACLU is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to defending civil rights and civil liberties. We are a domestic civil rights and civil liberties organization, so we do not generally take a position on international human rights issues and boycott campaigns like the Palestinian BDS movement. We are, however, vigorously committed to defending free expression and the right to dissent, which has been central to our mission since 1920. And it is in that capacity that we have weighed in against many of the censorship efforts targeted at Palestinian rights activists, including efforts to suppress BDS and other boycott of Israel campaigns. So I'll start off by talking about the federal legislation in this area. And I think the main piece of federal legislation to focus on is the Israel Anti-Boycott Act. This is a bill that has been introduced in every Congress since 2017, often with bipartisan support, which would make it a felony for any U.S. person to participate in boycotts of Israel or Israel's West Bank settlements if the boycott is called for by international governmental organizations like the UN Human Rights Council. And critically, the bill would also make it a crime to share information with the UN Human Rights Council about whether a company is operating in Israel's West Bank settlements. And I think the goal of that is basically to prevent the UN from identifying companies that are participating in human rights abuses by operating in the Israeli settlements in the West Bank. As I mentioned, this bill would make it a federal felony. The original version of the bill actually made it a felony with potentially 20 years of jail time for any U.S. person to participate in these boycotts if they're called for by the U.N. Fortunately, the bill has not advanced, has not been able to be enacted in the Congress. But if Republicans take back control of Congress next year, I think there's a very strong likelihood that we will see that bill advancing once again. At the state level, more than 30 states have passed laws or executive orders seeking to suppress boycotts of Israel. Their restrictions typically take two forms. On the one hand, many of these state laws require that these states divest their assets, for example, their pension funds, from any company that's found to be participating in a boycott of Israel or the settlements. And for this purpose, many of the states, including, for example, New York, have compiled blacklists of companies that they believe are participating in these BDS campaigns. On the other hand, many of these state laws also require government contractors to certify that they are not participating in boycotts of Israel or the settlements in order to get or to keep their government contracts. And actually, in the past few years, we've seen these laws expand out even beyond boycotts of Israel to encompass boycotts on other types of issues, whether it's boycotts of firearm manufacturers, fossil fuel companies, mining companies, timber interests, agriculture interests. So we can see on the conservative side of the aisle, the idea that this anti-boycott measure can be used to protect all sorts of different interests, even outside the Israel debate. And so it's becoming a template for censorship on a much broader array of issues. Our position at the ACLU since the Israel Anti-Boycott Act was first introduced, and even when many of these state laws were being introduced as early as 2015, is that these laws violate the First Amendment right to boycott. And I think in discussing this right, it's important to start with history behind it. There is a very long tradition of using boycotts as a protest tactic, both globally and in the United States. And I think, in fact, the American revolutionaries can be credited with really expanding the use of boycotts as a specifically political tool. During the American Revolution, Sons of Liberty and other revolutionary aligned groups entered into non-consumption and non-importation agreements targeting British goods. This is, of course, the famous Boston Tea Party, where the colonists dumped the British tea into the harbor in order to protest repressive legislation from Parliament, like the Stamp Act or the Tea Act. And historians have credited the participation in these boycott movements with the building of a national solidarity. It was actually some of the first votes taken by the Continental Congress were on these boycott measures. It created a uniquely American identity, and it really provided a major tool for the colonists to protest what they viewed as oppressive actions from the Parliament. Even going beyond the American Revolution, many of the first presidents of the United States and other significant political leaders like Alexander Hamilton participated in abolitionist boycott campaigns targeting slave-made goods from the American South. And boycotts of slave-made goods were important to the abolitionist movement right up through the Civil War. Moving further on into the modern era, of course, boycotts were central to the civil rights movement. And I think the Montgomery bus boycott is often seen as one of the landmark political protests in U.S. history. And that's, when Black citizens in Alabama said, we're not going to give our goods and give our time to the Montgomery bus system if the Montgomery bus system is going to tell us where to sit. Similarly, the boycotts, as Yusuf, I think, already mentioned, were essential to the campaign to convince South Africa to give up its apartheid regime. And that is, in fact, the inspiration for the Palestinian boycott movement. Even today, of course, boycotts are a central feature of American politics. They take place across the political spectrum. On the conservative side of the aisle, for example, there were boycotts of French-made goods to protest France's opposition to the Iraq War. I'm sure many of us remember the Freedom Fries. Similarly, Ted Cruz, for example, said that when Nike featured Colin Kaepernick in many of their advertising campaigns, Ted Cruz was opposed to this, said that Nike had exercised their First Amendment rights, so he was determined to exercise his, and that he was henceforth going to be participating in a boycott of Nike products. So I do think that there is actually widespread recognition once you step outside of the Israel-Palestine debate that boycotts are an essential protest tool and they're a fundamental part of free expression in the United States. Now let's get to the legal issue here. In NAACP versus Claiborne Hardware, which is a case from 1982, the Supreme Court unanimously held that the First Amendment protects the right to participate in politically motivated consumer boycotts. That case concerned a civil rights boycott of white-owned businesses in Port Gibson, Mississippi, to protest ongoing segregation and inequality in that community. The boycotted companies sued the NAACP and all of the boycott participants for tortious interference with business relations, and the state Supreme Court held the boycott participants collectively liable for all business losses resulting from the boycott. The U.S. Supreme Court unanimously reversed, holding that the boycott was a form of political protest resting on the highest rung of the hierarchy of First Amendment values, and that the power of the government to regulate economic activity could not justify the suppression of a politically motivated consumer boycott. So these state anti-boycott laws, from our perspective, completely infringe on the First Amendment right to participate in politically motivated consumer boycotts of goods and services, either from companies that are operating with the Israeli government or that are operating in Israeli settlements in the West Bank. One argument we often see in defense of these Israel anti-boycott laws is that they don't outlaw boycotts completely yet, although I think, at least with regards to the Israel Anti-Boycott Act in Congress, it does outlaw participation in certain kinds of boycotts completely. But at least with regards to the state bills, the government often says, we're not making it a crime to participate in these boycotts. We're merely boycotting the boycotters. And why doesn't the state government have that right to express its political views on this issue? But of course, the First Amendment protects the rights of the people, not the rights of the government. And it's been well established since the McCarthy era that the government cannot require public employees or government contractors to disavow participation in protected expression as a condition of getting or keeping a government job. And the foundational cases in that area, in that era, were, you know, when state and federal governments were essentially requiring public employees, university professors, contractors, other employees, to sign loyalty oaths, guaranteeing that they were not members of subversive groups or engaged in subversive political advocacy on their own private time and dime. And what the Supreme Court said is that although the government has some power to control your speech while you're at work for the government, what it can't do is use its economic leverage over private citizens to control their private expression on their own time and dime. So together with the Council on American Islamic Relations, the ACLU has filed lawsuits in, I think there's lawsuits have been filed by the ACLU or CARE in six states, Kansas, Arizona, Texas, Arkansas, Georgia, and Maryland. The plaintiffs of these cases come from all walks of life. For example, Esther Kuntz, the plaintiff in our Kansas case, was a substitute math teacher who participates in a boycott of Israel. And in order to teach math classes in Kansas, she was required to sign a form saying that she wouldn't boycott Israel or the settlements. Similarly, Nick Jordahl is a lawyer who provides legal services to the state of Arizona Department of Corrections. In order to continue providing those services, he was required to say that he wouldn't participate in a boycott of companies like Hewlett-Packard because of their business relationships with the Israeli government. In Arkansas, we represent the Arkansas Times, which is a community newspaper. They have advertising contracts with a local technical college. In order to continue publishing those advertisements and to keep their advertising contracts, they were required to certify that they don't participate in a boycott of Israel or the settlements. And then in cases like Texas, you have Bahia Maui, CARES client, who is a speech pathologist. We represented college students who wanted to judge high school debate tournaments. Journalists working for NPR affiliates, affiliated with a local university, all of them were required to sign these unconstitutional anti-boycott forms as a condition of keeping their government jobs. And we maintain that that violated the First Amendment. I'll just add one more example there, although it didn't result in a lawsuit. In Texas, after Hurricane Harvey, a Palestinian man who wanted to obtain hurricane relief funds from the government was initially required to sign a form promising that he would boycott Israel or the settlements in order to get funds to help rebuild his home. Fortunately, after public outcry, in that instance, the government retracted the certification demand. And in fact, when we've brought these lawsuits in federal court, the vast majority of the time, we've won. The federal courts have concluded that these laws unconstitutionally require our clients to disavow participation in protected political protests in order to keep a government job, and that the government has no legitimate interest in suppressing that expression. You know, one of the arguments we often see here, as Yusuf alluded to, is the government saying, well, these are actually discriminatory boycotts. And so our interest in preventing discrimination is a sufficient justification for removing the First Amendment protection from this political protest. And I think the really important thing to understand here is that the First Amendment does not extend its protections based on viewpoint. And so the First Amendment protects racist speech just as much as speech advocating equality. And one of the reasons for that is to remove those debates from the field of First Amendment expression. So people can argue until the cows come home about whether these boycotts are discriminatory or not. But at the end of the day, political protest and expression can't be censored based on its viewpoint, even if the court were to find that viewpoint offensive. I think the other really essential thing to point out with regards to these arguments is that these are not framed as anti-discrimination laws. These are not laws that say people cannot participate in discriminatory refusals to deal generally. These are laws that target politically motivated boycotts of a single country. And in doing so, I think they make it clear that the government's interest is not in preventing discrimination generally, but it's rather in suppressing one side of a political debate. And that's why they violate the First Amendment. Now, as I mentioned, most of the time we've been successful, but there was one case in particular where we were not successful in the district court. That was in Arkansas. There, the federal court held, in fact, that there is no First Amendment right to boycott. And I think the implications of that ruling are astoundingly broad. It would mean not only that the federal government could pass the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, but in fact, that any government in the United States could make it a crime to participate in disfavored boycott campaigns whether that's a campaign like the Montgomery Civil Rights Boycott, or is a campaign like the BDS boycott. And so that's an astounding power grab by the government to essentially decide whether consumers can make these politically motivated choices about whether to participate in a boycott or not. We ended up appealing that decision to the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. The court eventually held that the Arkansas law does violate the First Amendment, not necessarily because it prohibits participation in boycott campaigns directly. The court decided not to reach that issue, but it held that the law also suppresses and chills speech and association supporting a boycott. Because of the way the law was written, it is very plausible that the law could be applied to someone, for example, picketing outside a Best Buy, saying, don't buy Hewlett-Packard printers. Hewlett-Packard has contracts with the Israeli Defense Forces. And on that ground, the Eighth Circuit said that the law violated the First Amendment, and so it didn't need to address the broader question about whether the First Amendment protects boycotts or not. Since that happened, the full Eighth Circuit, the en banc Eighth Circuit, all 11 active judges have voted to rehear the case. The argument took place last September, and we're awaiting a decision from the Eighth Circuit now. And eventually, I think one of these cases, frankly, is going to go up to the Supreme Court, just because we've seen such a proliferation of laws in this area. And now the laws are expanding outside of this discrete issue area of Israel and Palestine and expanding into other sorts of boycott movements. And so sooner or later, I think the Supreme Court is going to recognize that it needs to step in and make clear, I think, what it already said clearly in Claiborne, which is that the First Amendment protects this activity. Touching just briefly on questions of media censorship, I think what I'll focus on have been concerning decisions by platforms like Zoom, which we're all using here today, to unilaterally withdraw service from events if it concludes that hosting a particular speaker would constitute material support for terrorism. And so one of the main examples here is when Zoom effectively shut down an event at San Francisco State University because the event was, you know, concerned gender and resistance narratives, featured Leila Khaled. And Zoom concluded that even having Leila Khaled talk at all at this event, regardless of what she was going to say, would amount to material support for terrorism. And I think it's important to point out here that no court has ever upheld such a broad reading of the material support statute to preclude academic discussions of this nature. And if the government were to attempt such a prosecution, it would almost certainly violate the First Amendment. But I think it's very troubling at a time when we're all increasingly relying on these teleconferencing platforms to communicate, to have academic discussions, that the platforms themselves are making these unilateral censorship decisions about which speakers can participate in an academic conference. And so I think that has been, you know, the theme underlying all of this, which is centralized decision makers, whether it's in the federal government, the state governments, or companies like Zoom, making decisions about which forms of protest are legitimate or not. And that's a question that the First Amendment takes off the table, at least with respect to government actors. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian, for this excellent review and update on the legislation issues, both state and federal, and the cases that you've been working on. Next, we have Mira, who will focus on academia, particularly repression on college campuses, threats to academic freedom, and false accusations and administrative actions against activists. Mira, you have 12 minutes.
Thanks, Tamara, and thanks to the Arab Center for this invitation and to my co-panelists and to the audience for being here. So Palestine Legal, we are a legal advocacy organization whose mission is to bolster the grassroots movement for Palestinian rights here in the US. We provide legal advice, know your rights trainings, advocacy, and litigation support to college students, activists, and others who are experiencing backlash for their advocacy and support of Palestinian rights. We also document and track the tactics that are being used to silence advocates. And so, you know, I think, you know, other panelists have mentioned, I just want to start with some sort of broader context and hone in on a few of the tactics that we've documented. There is a growing Palestine solidarity movement here in the US. It is student-led, it's diverse, it's dynamic, and it's increasingly interconnected with other racial justice struggles here, and it's filtering up from the grassroots. These calls for freedom, equality, and justice for Palestinians have been met with efforts to censor, chill, and punish. And Palestine Legal has documented the widespread censorship and harassment of Palestine activists over the years. Since 2014, we've documented more than 2,000 incidents of suppression, which is just the tip of the iceberg because it is what is, you know, reported to us. And, you know, what we've seen across these incidents is that advocates who speak out for Palestinian rights are routinely harassed, surveilled, threatened, falsely accused, censored, punished. You know, and so, you know, you've heard now about the harassing lawsuits and the legislation targeting advocacy for Palestinian rights from some of the other panelists. And I'd like to just focus on a couple of the other common tactics and the context that we've seen. I'm going to start with false accusations. False accusations of anti-Semitism and support for terrorism are the most common tactic that we've documented. And they lay the foundation for many other forms of repression and harassment. They rely on anti-Muslim, anti-Arab, anti-Palestinian tropes. And they, you know, these smear campaigns falsely portray activists who support Palestinian freedom as anti-Semitic or, you know, as supporters of terrorism. You know, more than 60% of the incidents that we've responded to involve these kinds of false accusations. So what does that look like? You know, it often involves online blacklists and other doxing sites that collect personal information about Palestinian rights advocates and falsely accuse them of anti-Semitism or terrorism for their, you know, because of their support for Palestinian rights. And these smear campaigns often generate sort of cruel cyber harassment campaigns. You know, they can involve astroturfed petitions. They can also involve tagging law enforcement agencies or employers to pressure them to punish these advocates for Palestinian rights. There are a number of different players here, you know, in this space. Canary Mission is perhaps one that many have heard of. StopAntisemitism.org, BDS Report. Until recently, there was also, you know, ACT.IL, which is a mobile phone app that was funded in part by the Israeli government that rewarded users to you know, who sent, you know, these pre-drafted complaints that included false accusations. And what these campaigns do and are intended to do is to really chill debate and to justify punitive action against advocates for Palestinian rights. While schools or employers, you know, face pressure to punish and investigate and question advocates, the advocates themselves, you know, receive this sort of mass onslaught of threatening, violent, and racist messages. And so, you know, I think what's happened in recent years, and, you know, I think this connects back to what both Brian and Yusuf had mentioned, is, you know, in an effort to add legitimacy to these false anti-Semitism accusations, Israel advocacy groups have really lobbied for legislation and policies that would codify these smears into law by redefining anti-Semitism to encompass nearly all criticism of Israel. You know, these redefinition efforts have come under different names and iterations, but the most prevalent is probably the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition, or IHRA definition. And this definition, you know, it blurs the lines between anti-Semitism and criticism of Israel, and it will result in the censorship of constitutionally protected political speech. This is not a theoretical concern or, you know, a future abstract concern, but it's one that we know because how Israel advocates have wielded this definition even before it's been codified into law. At this stage, you know, at least Florida, South Carolina, Texas, and Arizona have laws adopting some version of this definition. And in December of 2019, Donald Trump signed an executive order directing government agencies to consider this distorted definition when investigating discrimination allegations, which led to a flurry of complaints filed against universities for permitting Palestine advocacy on campus. Many of those are still pending. I'm going to stop on the sort of false accusations piece, but I just want to say in terms of legislation, we have more resources on our website where we're tracking and analyzing these bills, as well as the anti-boycott bills that are targeting advocacy for Palestinian rights here in the US. And I want to turn now to the campus context. And really, I want to probably give more examples, but, you know, I think important to set some context here that, you know, in last May, as part of the Unity uprising, we saw, you know, greater numbers of people from all different sectors speaking out in support of Palestinian rights. But college campuses continue to be a significant context for Palestine solidarity, as well as the backlash to it. Nearly 60% of the incidents that Palestine Legal responded to in 2021 targeted students and scholars at 81 different campuses across the country. And the numbers evidence, I think, you know, the importance and vibrancy of this space for organizing in support of Palestinian rights. I think one good example of this, Tufts University's Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP, was given a collaboration award in 2020 for their Deadly Exchange campaign, which was an effort to end collaboration between U.S. police and Tufts police in particular with Israeli military and security forces. More than 40 other student groups eventually joined this campaign, representing a wide cross-section of the student body. And the subsequent referendum on the issue passed with overwhelming support and participation. And so, you know, I think that that's an example of sort of what the vibrancy and organizing on college campuses looks like. You know, in terms of the repression, in turn, you know, often, you know, it can take the form of sort of microaggressions, perhaps, or bureaucratic barriers, which, you know, could include denying or delaying funding and room reservations for student group events, requiring balance of Palestine-related programs with pro-Israel programming, or requiring quote-unquote neutral moderators, or pressuring advocates to change their speakers or issue disclaimers distancing themselves from the school, or imposing police presence on events or charging for extra security. But we've also seen, you know, a more egregious threats on college campuses, ranging from censorship, investigations into students and faculty for their Palestine advocacy, and threats to academic freedom. So earlier this month, CUNY's John Jay College canceled a student-organized conference commemorating the Nakba. The school claimed that organizers had failed to follow proper procedures and also cited to a lack of adequate security. But the alleged procedural irregularities were flagged only days before the event. And, you know, even after the organizers acceded to the school's additional security demands, you know, the school refused to still canceled the event, which, you know, I think suggests that the decision to cancel was really about the content and the viewpoint of the conference, which would be unconstitutional. And, you know, we've seen this over and over where procedural excuses have been weaponized against Palestine advocates as an excuse to justify censorship of campus advocacy. Another sort of similar example, last year, Butler University canceled a talk with Dr. Angela Davis just 3 days before the event was scheduled to take place following complaints over Davis's support for Palestinian freedom. The university blamed the student government for supposedly failing, again, to follow proper procedures. And it was only after pressure from Palestinian students and their allies that the university eventually reinstated the event. You know, another sort of example, and I'm going to offer a few of these that kind of give you a range of the different types of situations we've seen at St. John's University, also in New York, at their virtual commencement ceremony last year. The school censored a Palestinian doctoral student, deleting, you know, "Free, Free Palestine" from her graduation slide, and claiming it was, you know, violated a policy against defamatory, libelous, obscene, immoral, or fraudulent behavior and conduct. So after the student complained, the school eventually did restore the language to her slide, but this was only, you know, days after the ceremony had already taken place. So this, and finally, just, you know, in terms of course content, you know, scholarship, we've also seen Israel advocacy groups launch smear campaigns based on instructors' viewpoints. And at UNC Chapel Hill, a member of Congress and an Israeli diplomat met with school officials to pressure them to cancel a course on the conflict over Israel-Palestine. And I think, you know, it's important. There's so many more examples I can pull from, but I want to, you know, just note that, you know, the unique impact, I think, of the repression on Palestinians in particular, and Palestinian students, faculty, and employees have faced, you know, amplified discrimination and harassment on campus and other contexts, often being singled out from their allies for bullying and false accusations. So at Florida State University in June 2020, Ahmed Omar Daraldik was the first Palestinian elected as president of the FSU Student Senate. Following his election, he became the target of a vicious cyberbullying and harassment campaign aimed at removing him from his position and attacking him for expressing his outrage over Israel's treatment of Palestinians. Even state lawmakers joined into this chorus of attacks, contributing to an anti-Palestinian environment. And, you know, Palestine Legal has stepped in to support Ahmed in filing a Title VI complaint with the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights over this anti-Palestinian environment at Florida State University. Another example from George Washington, also from last year, a university office that offered trauma counseling and support to the GW community, offered a healing space for Palestinian community members in the midst of the Unity Uprising and in the midst of the forced evictions and military attacks on Gaza last May and June that killed hundreds of Palestinians and, you know, devastated infrastructure there. The office, you know, had previously offered these types of healing spaces for Asian students, Black students, and other community members impacted by racism or state violence during that same year. But within 24 hours of advertising the support service on Instagram, GW administrators directed the office to cancel the event and remove the post. So, you know, the result here, Palestinians were denied access to trauma services at a time when relatives and community members were under attack, you know, denied an equal access to university services that other students, you know, had benefited from, which is arguably a form of discrimination. And Palestine Legal has filed a complaint under the DC Human Rights Act that is still pending. I want to give one more example, I think, if I have just a minute. The City University of New York School of Law, CUNY Law, a law student there, Nardine Kisweni, is a well-known activist for Palestinian freedom and a frequent target of Zionist groups who've deployed, you know, vicious smear campaigns and false accusations of anti-Semitism to vilify her. Since she started at CUNY Law in fall 2019, anti-Palestinian students and groups like StopAntiSemitism.org and BDS Report have targeted Nardine using these cyberbullying tactics. And in September of 2020, she faced a sort of a character assassination campaign after she posted an old video of herself waving a lighter while criticizing a friend for wearing a t-shirt promoting the Israeli military. And, you know, a vilification campaign based on this incident followed and was bolstered in part by ACT.IL, the Israeli government affiliated app, which rewarded users if they sent pre-scripted emails to the CUNY administration that falsely claimed that Nardine had threatened a Zionist fellow student and called for her to be punished. So CUNY Law initially released statements condemning Nardine, which were later deleted, exposing her to even further racist and violent sort of messages and vitriol online. And in June 2021, you know, after months of student pressure, CUNY Law finally issued a statement in support of Nardine, saying that the law school, quote, supports the free speech rights of Nardine Kisweni, other Palestinian students, and their Jewish and non-Jewish allies who have been vilified for their activism, end quote. And so I think just an example that also shows when there's mobilization and pushback against this kind of repressive backlash, you know, that there are important opportunities there as well to you know, support activists in their expression and support of Palestinian rights. So I wanted to circle back really quickly to what Yusuf had started with in terms of where is this coming from, just to connect a few more dots here, because, you know, he mentioned the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, which is, you know, an Israeli ministry that has identified boycotts and BDS in particular as an existential threat, devoting, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to fighting it. But I think it's also important to highlight that, you know, pro-Israel groups in the U.S. are working closely with right-wing groups here, and that are fueling suppression and dissent, sort of attacks on dissent across different social justice movements. And I want to mention in particular here, sort of connected to the legislative piece, the role of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. And this is, you know, an organization that brings together conservative legislators and corporate lobbyists to develop and disseminate model legislation that safeguards corporate power and white supremacy. It's responsible for sort of pushing bills such as Stand Your Ground laws and voter ID laws that have targeted communities of color in particular. And they've been, you know, part of the process of developing and advocating legislation targeting advocacy for Palestinian rights, including anti-boycott bills and these anti-Semitism redefinition bills as well. I think it's important to note the role of these right-wing groups and what it signals about the sort of anti-progressive nature of the anti-Palestinian repression we're seeing across these different sectors. And, you know, I think it kind of shows that these anti-Palestinian efforts are of a piece with other regressive and racist efforts to quash dissent here. And, you know, I think you see this most clearly in the legislative context where, you know, as Brian mentioned, the anti-BDS bills have become a template for punishing other justice movements. But I think it's also significant in other areas beyond legislation as well, in terms of the tactics of repression that we're seeing and that are common, I think, to many justice movements here. And, you know, I think it's a sign that the repression, it's an indication, right? The repression is not unique to Palestinian rights advocacy. It's clearly part of a broader context where, you know, there's a crackdown on protesters, human rights defenders, and those dissenting from the status quo. But I think it also underscores the importance of, you know, cross-movement solidarity to address these repressive efforts together and the need to organize and build relationships across communities and movements. Because ultimately, you know, we see that the tide is turning. We see an increased awareness of and opposition to Israel's treatment of Palestinians. And even in the face of these, you know, repressive measures, we see that, you know, SJP chapters are growing, BDS wins accumulate, and they are filtering up from the grassroots to mainstream media and decision makers. So I'm going to stop here. I just want to say, though, you know, please don't hesitate to reach out to Palestine Legal if you need legal support related to your advocacy for Palestinian rights. We are happy to be your resource, and I look forward to the questions. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Mira, for this. And thanks to all of the panelists for these excellent remarks.
You have been listening to Yusuf Monair of the Middle East Institute, Brian House from the ACLU, and Mira Shah from Palestine Legal, discussing their work defending Palestine dissenters in the United States. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, where you can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. You can also stream us live on Sunday evenings at KKRN.org at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you will get involved with the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We will talk again next week.